So I just want to mention that next week, a week from today, we're going to have Gordon Laxer down here from the Parkland Institute, and he's going to be speaking about what's going on with the energy security of the United States and how is it possible that has anything to do with us. It seems to be the primary driver in the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and I'm sure Gordon will have a lot to say on the subject. So people in the television audience, it's great to have you in the audience on TV, but maybe you want to come out and hear that one live. Just like Diane's presentation today, it's going to affect all of us. And with that, I'll invite Diane back up. And questioners, please, take your rows here, and we'll start it up. Thank you.
Howard Forsyth, if you give me less than a minute with a personal thing. My youngest daughter is a lawyer for Sears Roebuck in Washington, Maryland, Virginia, on court cases. And I said, as I often say in the senior context, the best half of your life might be after you retire, the most productive, the most interesting. I said, come to Alberta, which is the best place on the continent to live, get a PhD in political science, and carry on where I failed. She says, Dad, I don't have the passion. So the word is passion. Tell me what of all the very good stuff you said you feel most passionate about.
I feel. Oh, I got to tell you, as soon as you said that, what flashed in front of my eyes was something that's really happened to me. I'm passionate about keeping that watershed intact, especially the forests and all the species associated with it. And what flashed before my eyes when I was young, I mean, Joni Mitchell's song was out. They cut all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And in the 70s, early 70s, I was working on the Great Divide Trail, a trail route along the eastern slopes from Waterton up to Banff, so people could hike along the backbone of the continent, hike or horseback ride. And into the 80s, we know in the 1980s, the last drainage basin of any size left completely intact in the Old Man watershed, Old Man River Basin, was the north branch of the Old Man River, the northwest branch of the Old Man River, upstream, west of the Forestry Trunk Road, upstream of the mouth of the Livingston River. And I'd already hiked a lot in Kananaskis country and so on and various other places. And when I first saw that valley, I thought, oh, my goodness, we still have a chance because it was still intact, completely intact. That was in the 1980s. And as conservation groups, we fought hard to keep that place intact. In the end, only one piece of it is today. The rest has been clear-cut logging. And there is trees in there. I took photos. The Forest Service accused us of taking photos on the BC side of the border because there was lady ferns that stood this high and really magnificent forests in that watershed. But it was logged. And a couple of years ago when a new exhibit opened at the Provincial Museum called Wild Alberta, I went to see the exhibit, and I came around the corner, and there was a big panorama of a place that I knew but no longer existed, and it was a view of Mount Beehive. And it was an example of the alpine ecosystem. But the place that picture was taken was no longer intact. It's gone. And so we're saving the last bits in the Old Man. And we're with climate change now, we are desperately running out of time. And it's going to take everybody's action. It's going to take people speaking up, writing the letters, and phoning your MLAs. Don't be shy about it at all, because we're down to our last bits now. Aside from Waterton, the last drainage, the northwest branch, the Old Man is gone. So we've got these last bits. The castle's already damaged, but it is our best water tower that we've got, and we've got to start taking care of it. Thanks.
Thanks, Anne. Please introduce yourself before your question.
I think Howard did introduce himself. Maybe you missed it. Everybody knows Howard, and some people know me. I'm Mark Sandilands. Diane, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. It brought back memories to me of traveling the Forestry Trunk Road when I was about that tall. I think I was 10 years old, and my parents took me and my sister up there camping. We drove from Coleman to Seabee on the Forestry Trunk Road over, at that time, the highest engineered pass in Canada, maybe North America, I can't remember. The Highwood Pass is over 6,000 feet. Anyway, the other image that came to my mind is of the precious nature of that land up there and the problem that we have in establishing a figure for its value. I know the logging companies can count trees and through various formulas calculate the number of board feet of timber in a stand of forest. But other economists I've heard have looked at the value that these kinds of land give to us in terms of protecting our water, filtering our water, collecting it, and doling it out gradually in the summer months rather than having it all come down in a rush like it did here in 1995. I think that flood that many of us, probably all of us in this room, remember was made worse by the fact that some of the water was not trapped in the upper Old Man Basin. I've heard a figure in the trillions of dollars for worldwide value that nature gives us in terms of our ecosystem and our lives. Is there any way possible to calculate the value just in a particular watershed that so we could compare that against the board feet of timber?
Good question. After Howard's question, I'm going to preface the answer with, first off, when you talk about values, don't forget about the intrinsic values, the passionate values. Don't forget about stating those. Don't limit everything just to the economics. Because it was the passion of knowing those places that caused people to have the foresight that set aside the forestry reserve. As far as measuring economic values, yes, there are ways to do it. They're called ecological goods and services. There's a whole school of economics that deals with figuring out those values. It hasn't been done here in many cases in Alberta. It's often just left out of the equation. And actually, your very question was what the Crow's Nest Pass Advisory Committee pointed out to Sustainable Resource Development regarding the C5, the Crow's Nest Forest Management Plan. They said, you gave us values in here related to the timber, but where are the value? We want to see the calculations for the value of recreation, the value of the water coming from this watershed. So they've asked that those values be calculated and used in the planning. So I'd encourage all of you to ask that of the minister, that that be done for the forestry reserve. One set that I know that's been looked at to some extent is related to parks, legislated protected areas, provincial parks. There was a discussion paper done during the Special Places 2000 process, which ended in 2001, so it was prior to 2001, looking at the direct economic benefits from the legislated protected areas, the various kinds of parks, and comparing that on a hectare-by-hectare basis to the forest industry and the oil and gas industry. And if I recall correctly, it was probably 1996 data used, maybe off in a few years. The outcome of that, because there's a lot more land allocated to the forest industry and the oil and gas industry than there is to parks, so you need to compare equivalent bases, so they use on a hectare-by-hectare basis. For parks, the benefits to Alberta economy were roughly equivalent to the forest industry on a hectare-by-hectare comparison. Of course, the oil and gas industry was higher because of the high price of that non-renewable commodity. But when it comes to employment, it was in the same ballpark. And again, on employment side, parks on a hectare-by-hectare comparison to the forest industry were comparable to the jobs with the park jobs were comparable to the forest industry jobs. So certainly looking at the benefits coming from parks, some of that economic work's been done. Definitely needs to be done for the old man, for the castle and the old man, the C5.
Thank you, Diane, for authoritative, powerful statement. Ultimately, the decisions that you were talking about are political. And the question I want to ask you is a political question. And it concerns the politics of Mr. Morton and the government. Mr. Morton, as you know, ran for premier, had to be included in the cabinet somewhere, was given what was seen to be the lowest, almost the lowest portfolio of natural resources. In protocol of the cabinet, he is at the bottom, or close to the bottom, isn't he? I don't have confidence in Mr. Morton, myself. I've heard him in speeches talk about a firewall around Alberta, the importance of it, of Alberta perhaps separating from Canada, the possibility of it, and dubious notions about Quebec's role in Canada. His support comes from the resource industry, basically from the support industry, and other areas of sociology in Alberta, which are rural, often religious right. In any event, his judgments have not been impressive to me. The authority of this government in the last 20, 30 years in its environmental ministers has not been a distinguished one at all. So I have fears about the kind of decisions that Mr. Morton and his portfolio are going to make or going to support, and have concerns about this government and its dedication. I'm being very frank. We don't want to embarrass the Sierra Club as you or you as your spokesperson, but I think we need to face up to these political realities and be honest about them and ask ourselves how can we best campaign in a democratic manner to help change them along the lines that you were speaking about. Thank you. My question, the Sierra Club and yourself, what can you please give us a reading on where you think the government's position as a government, because I don't think we can depend on Mr. Morton. As a government, however, we have another ultimate. Do you mind such a straightforward question?
I have to give you kind of an aside to this, which most people don't realize. Many of the environmental and conservation organizations and many of the advocacy organizations, even when it comes to social justice, are registered charities in Canada. And registered charities are limited in the amount of advocacy work they can do, which is called political activity by Canadian Revenue Agency. So anything we do to retain or amend or change an existing policy or legislation of any level of government, municipal or provincial or federal, falls within that 10% rule. We can't do more than that. So, for example, that's why you come elections, you don't hear environmental organizations saying, speaking out on the environmental issues and which policy is which party is headed the right direction according to a set of questions. Sierra Club of Canada is a bit unique, though, in that we're two organizations. We're Sierra Club of Canada Foundation and then Sierra Club of Canada. It's only the foundation that has the charitable tax status. So like when you give a membership or donation to us, you're asked up front if you're encouraged to consider not asking for a tax receipt because that allows us to use your donation as we see fit on advocacy, and we're not limited by the 10% rule. So just keep that in mind. Some people are always saying, well, why don't we hear more from the environmental groups on these issues, especially at the time of the election? And that's why most everybody's limited to the 10% rule. But your bigger question, which I think is, what to do? When you look at the priorities the premier gave the ministers, in there, the Water for Life strategy is a priority. Having a biodiversity strategy is a priority. Making sure the park system addresses the population growth in Alberta is a priority. They're all useful priorities to move forward a conservation agenda. So my suggestion is to hold the ministers to it. They need to deliver on those priorities prior to the next election. So pick one of those priorities and hold the ministers to it. How you hold them to it is, you know, the old standbys and advocacy, the phone calls, getting your neighbors to phone, write the letters, get the letters to the editor in the paper, have forums like this. It's a lot of work, but it can really pay off. And there is a general expectation out there that things should change and need to change and are going to change from the previous government. And again, the priorities are there, so take them to task on those priorities. So when Ted Morton's priority is the health of a forest, take them to task on the health of a forest ecosystem. How are you delivering on that? Not just on how are you cutting down trees for pine beetles, but how are you delivering on the health of the forest ecosystem, and where are you actually applying it? On a somewhat positive note, I do know that he asked to meet with Dr. David Schindler regarding watersheds and what's going on with what his department has been doing in managing forests for the forest industry. So he has been asking people, and he did delay C5. So he sort of said, okay, I've opened the door a bit. If I hear from a pile of people, okay, I'll change things. But if I only hear from a few, well, maybe I'll close the door and just approve C5. So it's really important that everybody takes action.
Diane, it's my experience that many of the users of water downstream in the basin, municipalities, agricultural interests, particularly irrigation, don't link their use to the forest reserve, which presentations like this are trying to address. But I would just like your thoughts on the argument, well, who cares how much water runs off quickly from the forest reserves? We'll just build a dam and store it and then have our water that way. I'd like just to know you've probably thought through that to some extent, and I'd like to know some of your thoughts about dams and reservoirs versus putting efforts into protecting the headwaters.
Okay, I have a two-part answer. First part is the catchment role of the forest reserve. The intact and virgin forests perform that role the best. They keep the snows there. And we're in a Chinook belt, and what happens if there's a large clear cuts in any one of those streams, a Chinook comes through and the water is gone from the basin. It's not that it runs off, it's gone, most of it. The snow actually goes from the crystal form into the vapor and it's gone into the atmosphere. It's called sublimation. So that's part of it. Don't assume that, oh, well, it melts sooner and therefore it runs off and we can collect it in a dam. And you can, if you spend time, I encourage you to make the effort to spend time in the forest reserve in the winter, like February, and go in the headwaters of any one of these, the castle, the old man. And you can visually see that in the clear cut. The snow will be like this if it's there at all. And if there's a good stand of mature forest somewhere in that basin, you'll be thigh deep in snow inside that stand. So that's one part. And then the other part is, so what if it runs off earlier, we're catch it all in the dams? With climate change dams, those big impoundments are big evaporation ponds. Building a dam is extremely expensive. If I remember, with the Old Man Dam, at that time, the cost was about $2,000 per family in Alberta to construct that dam. Constructing dams is way more expensive than protecting the watershed in the first place. We're a rich province, but there's better places to put the money, better places to restoration and dealing with the linear disturbances up in the headwaters in the forestry reserve than building more dams. And then dams bring with them all their own problems, which living in Lethbridge, I hope most you're aware about, and Cheryl did some of the research work, but the health of the riparian ecosystems and those cottonwood forests, which we all make use of in the summertime in particular, depends on the natural cycles of the river. That's how it evolved, and the flooding and so on. When you put a dam in, you change the complete hydrology of that river system, and you can lose, as has happened on the St. Mary's, you lose your riparian forests. It's what a dam does to the hydrology and the adverse effects from it is so well understood in some places, that, particularly in the U.S., they are decommissioning dams because they're better off without the dam. So dams are an old, out-of-date solution that's going to yield more problems than yield water.
Terry Shillington. Thank you, Diane, for your presentation and your expertise on the subject. I'm going to try and refrain from repeating some of Gordon's remarks, but I come with those in the background. But I'm thinking one of the problems with politicians managing the environment is that they work on a four-year cycle, and the issues are more long-term than that. And I wonder, I think as one political tool, it'd be probably helpful to ask politicians for a 20-year plan or a 10-year plan or something. But I wonder if you people have done projections in that kind of time range and if it's in any kind of form that could be used in conversations with politicians, the long-term projections of where we're going.
Well, the long-term projections, people have pulled that together. So far as the Southern Foothills study, landholder groups, Southern Alberta Land Trust, municipalities have all pooled their funds and resources to hired Brad Stelfox. He's completed that work and was doing presentations on it. I don't know, did you have Brad Stelfox here?
No, but we had the Kisco
landholder. Yeah, the Kisco landholder groups, good. What he did is he looked at the all the different sectors, the forest industry, the oil and gas industry, housing development, and so on, and the government's business plans for each of those sectors for the future. A business plan is for more than just 1 or 2 years. And through a model, mapped out what all that would look like if everybody delivered on their business plan and presented that picture. For Southern Alberta, the study area is from Highway 3 north to, I'm trying to remember, north to certainly including Pekisko, west of Longview, so part way up into Kananaskis country, both the public lands and the forest reserve and the deeded lands and the ranching foothills. And when you see that, I mean, the picture is a disaster. It's not sustainable at all. So to that extent, it's been mapped out using the model that Brad Stelfox developed and presenting that to the politicians to show them you can't keep going the way you've been going. Changes have to be made. So that much has been done. And on the water side of it, I do encourage you to read the Rosenberg report, because Dr. David Schindler's summary of the state of the basin for the Saskatchewan, because that his work in conjunction with the climatologists sort of point to what you've been hearing in the press is that we're going to have way less water and a much warmer climate. The trees we know of in our forest reserve, trees are going to start retreating elevation-wise. Glacier National Park, I haven't gone to look out for it on the park site, but it's the model has been done so you can visually see on your computer the forested lands retreating in glacier. The glacier's gone. Forest lands retreating and grasslands moving up to what's currently alpine. So that'll be happening up along the southern, the headwaters of the Old Man. We'll be losing forest. And in reality, forest clear cut today probably won't grow forest again. An old growth forest in the headwaters is starting at about 55 years of age. And then as well,